Baltimore County School Board have decided to expel Dexter from the entire public school system.
Oh, Mr. Kirk, I'm as upset as you to learn Dexter's 2 and 3. But surely expulsion is not the answer.
I'm afraid expulsion is the only answer. It's the opinion of the entire staff that Dexter is criminally insane.
And I'm Dick Turnip.
On today's episode, we'll be discussing the recent death of former Apple CEO Steve Jobs. We'll be reviewing Kevin Mitnick's latest book, Ghost in the Wires. We'll also be looking at the latest exploits available from ExploitDB, and we'll be examining the latest news in the world of IT. So how you doing, Dick? We've been off this for a few weeks. We're just getting back into the run once again.
Yeah, I'm good. I've probably got a bit of podcast rust, as we were talking about just before.
Yeah. Me and Dick did try to record this, and we made a few hiccups at the start, so we're on our second run here, but hopefully back into the swing of things. We've had some feedback on Twitter and other various mediums, and people were looking forward to the episode, and we didn't have it out last week, unfortunately. But look, we're back now. We're good to go.
We're both sort of in good health.
I've
caught a cold off my son.
Yeah, we were both sick the last week. I was down with the flu, and poor Dick was sick too.
I'm still a bit sick now, but I'm getting there.
We're getting there. So me and Dick were talking. We were talking earlier on IRC about Lake Vostok. Tell us a bit about this lake, Dick. Why is it so special?
Well, Lake Vostok, it's located in Antarctica, and basically it's a lake about, was it 3,488 meters below the East Antarctic ice sheet. And what makes it so special is that this lake could have been basically cut off from all outside influences for the last 15 to 25 million years. Now, they've took core samples, they've drilled down, they've got these core samples, and they've found extremophile organisms. So basically there is life in the ice sheet above the lake, but apparently the lake is rich in oxygen, and there could be a good chance that there might be some species that have never been seen before, that are millions of years old, that have been living in this pocket of their own life, really.
Okay, so basically what happened is that when the ice sheets were forming last over Antarctica about 15 to 20 million years ago, this lake was covered over, and it's under about 2 to 3 miles of ice. The lake is underneath it, and anything that would have been underneath that sheet of ice 15 to 20 million years ago would have been completely cut off from everywhere else on Earth. So any sort of microbial life that formed there could be completely different to anything that's alive today, and even animals that we once thought were extinct could still be alive there. Now, I can't imagine any sort of large life underneath it, but they did say that it's very oxygen rich. It's a very oxygen rich environment, so there could be fish. There could be weird fish still down there. It's a real interesting topic. I think everyone should at least have a look at the Wikipedia page for it. It's Lake Vostok, and that's Vostok.
I think the really interesting thing about this lake is that if they can manage to get into this lake and probe it, you know, without sending contaminants in from our world, basically, because it is like a mini world in itself, it's being that isolated, then they could take the lessons learned from this and take it to the likes of Europa, which is one of Jupiter's moons. And basically, Europa could be a huge Lake Vostok.
So Europa is it's one of Jupiter's moons, and it's under a very thick sheet of ice, and they understand that there's a lake underneath the actual ice. So the ice sheet could be a lot thicker than Lake Vostok. But what they said about Lake Vostok is that it's not, I think it's only 2 to 3 degrees below freezing, and the reason why it remains liquid at below freezing temperatures is because of the pressure of the ice above, so that keeps it. And there's also a volcanic activity underneath at a crust level, which would heat up the water and also gaseous vents and so forth. So yeah, it would be a test bed for how life might exist on the likes of Europa. So it is very interesting. It's a very interesting topic, and I was browsing the Wikipedia page today for a good half hour over a cup of tea. It's just an interesting read. It's something different to look at.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that you see, you hear about it, and you think, wow, does that actually exist? Because the first time I heard about it was I was actually watching a BBC space program, and that's how they were talking about the whole Europa concept, and they mentioned Lake Vostok, and I just thought, wow, that's really interesting, that's amazing. But the other thing that interests me is Lake Vostok might be sealed off from our known world, so to speak. But there is other lakes around that area, and scientists using ground penetrating radar notice that every so often the lake will drop, the volume of water will drop, and other lakes around the area will fill. So the water there's currents, and they don't know what actually causes this drop, but it's not a static environment. It's not like just a pool of super chilled water. It actually moves around.
Sure, it's very interesting, and it would be nice to see if they found life that we thought was extinct at some point in the last 10, 15 million years, and they found it again. You have to understand that life in even the last 10,000 years, 10 to 20,000 years, the difference in life that we saw, I suppose, at the end of the last ice age, which I think was about 25,000 years ago, we saw the fall of Neanderthal man. The last mammoth died, I think, about less than 2,000 years ago on an island just off the coast, of Norway. I can't pronounce it. I think it's Svalbard or something to that effect. I'm not very good at pronouncing Nordic words. But so, I mean, here's that life that existed not too long ago, and we're talking only 25,000 years, that could be still alive today if it wasn't for the conditions that they met. Now, if we look back at 15 to 20 million years ago, we're looking at really, really a completely different world. A different environment and completely different life that could have, and you have to understand that if there was life that was sealed off, they could have also evolved over those 15 to 20 million years. So they've evolved in their own unique and closed off environment. So it's an interesting topic, and anybody who's interested, I'd recommend just have a look at the wiki page. It's Lake Vostok, and that's Vostok. So moving along to the latest news, we have a new release from Nmap. They've added IPv6 OS detection. There's also 30 more scripts added, and updates, just general updates on the Nmap software itself. So they've added a few scripts, bringing a total of 246 scripts to it. So it's interesting that they've actually added IPv6 OS detection. Now, I haven't updated my release of Nmap probably in about a year or two. And I haven't been testing at all against IPv6 targets, so I haven't really been keeping an eye on this. But it's an interesting topic in terms of the realms of security itself.
Yeah, I'm being quite lax in learning about IPv6. I know it's there. I know it's 128 bits. I'm pretty ignorant as to what the sort of ramifications in the future will be for upgrading to IPv6. Be interesting to get someone onto the show to talk about IPv6. I know we've got Wirespeed lined up who more than happily cover the subject, so I think we should maybe get him on for a chat.
Wirespeed is he's a CCIE from Cisco, so he's pretty clued up when it comes to networking. IPv6 is just one of those topics that a lot of people don't want to touch just yet, because we haven't seen a transition over from IPv4 to IPv6, so they haven't bothered. But at some point they will have to, because we're running out of address space, the IPv4 address space. It's only 32 bits. And when it was originally created, IPv4, they weren't expecting to be the demand for IP addresses to exist that, you know, to the levels that we have them today. They didn't expect the microcomputer to take off in the way that it did. And they've poorly managed the address space as well. I mean, there's a lot of people with the class A address ranges that are completely soaking up addresses that could be evenly distributed in a more efficient manner. But just to quickly touch on IPv6 for anyone who's not familiar with it, it's an enhancement on previous releases of Internet Protocol. The address space is 128 bits in comparison to 32 bits. There's probably more IPv6 addresses than there is grains of sand on the earth. So that gives you an idea of how large the address space is. There's a lot of neat features like stateless address auto configuration. So how that works is, unlike DHCP, where you send a request for an IP address from your router, which will provide the leaks back to you, what it does is it actually auto configures an IP address. It gives itself its own IP address. The only thing it has to obtain from the router is the actual configuration information for that network. Now, it also has obviously DHCP to which is implemented for IPv6. When we're going to transition from IPv4 to IPv6 on a broad scale is anyone's guess. I'm assuming at some point in the next 10 years, but until we're forced to do so, I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, companies don't want to spend money, really. That's the whole top and bottom of it. They don't want to spend the money to transition people over. I think it's to do with probably a lot to do with the current economical climate, but this isn't a subject that I really know a lot about, which is why Spade will be dismayed about when he listens to this. He'll be thinking, "Dick Turnip, you little nutter."
Well, we'll get him on it. We'll get him on pretty soon to do, and we'll get him to touch on IPv6 in a lot more detail. I covered the topic 2 semesters in college, IPv6 specifically, and I know that the IPv6 Centre for Ireland here is actually based in my city. It's based in Waterford. So there's a lot of research to be done in IPv6, and especially in the realm of security, it's very under-researched by a lot of people. For example, IPsec support is mandatory in IPv6, and the routing is a lot more efficient too. So it's a topic that people should be looking into, because at some point, especially if you're a network admin, this is something that you may have a kind of a broad understanding of, but you don't have an in-depth understanding of. So it's something that you're going to have to learn at some point. So moving along, we had a huge debt in the world of IT this week when we lost Steve Jobs.
Yeah, it's quite big news, isn't it? It's 56. It's no age to go. I think he was it pancreatic cancer. No,
Yeah,
he died
yeah.
of.
Yeah, 56 years old. He's been suffering with cancer for about 7 years. He was back and forth. There was a lot of back and forth in terms of going to Apple, coming, leaving for health reasons, coming back to Apple and leaving. But credit to him, in the time that he did work while he was suffering with cancer, he did take Apple to new levels, and it's one of the most successful companies today. Steve was born in San Francisco in February of 1955. He died on October 5th, leaving behind him a huge legacy. He was pivotal in terms of getting Apple off the ground originally with Steve Wozniak, where they created the Apple One computer, which it gave more accessibility to people in terms of computing at home. Prior to this, there was some kits like the Altair 8800, which allowed people to, have access to microcomputers. But prior to this, I mean, most computing was done at a corporate level. They were huge room-sized systems, costing tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands. And it was around the late 70s, mid to late 70s, that we saw the microcomputers starting to enter homes, and Apple was one of the companies that really assisted this. Steve Wozniak, I suppose, was more of the technical side of things, and Steve Jobs was the guy who kind of understood the business aspects of it a little bit more.
Well, the interesting thing is Steve Jobs and was Steve Wozniak had sort of different ethoses about how the Apple One should be, well, should be brought to market, so to speak, because Steve Wozniak originally wanted to give it away. As my understanding goes, he wanted to, you know, give the information away to the Homebrew Computer Club so that people could build Apple Ones for themselves. And it was Steve Jobs, even back then, that took it, created a business model, and that was it. That was the birth of the sort of the first real home computer, the accessible home computer. So you can credit Steve Jobs in a way with bringing the personal computer to the world.
Yeah.
I know it was Steve Wozniak that created it, but Steve Jobs had the, you know, like the vision to make it accessible to the masses.
Sure. And without Steve Jobs, Apple could actually be out of business today. It wouldn't be the company that it is today, that's for sure. And Steve, you know, he was back and forth with Apple. He wasn't always with Apple. He was actually let go from Apple. He created his own company called Next, where he created strong, powerful systems, Next computers. And that eventually he was almost bankrupt with that. I think it was eventually bought out by Apple. Strangely enough, and he did go back to Apple in the end, and he brought it to new heights with the likes of the iPod, iPad, iPhone, and turned Apple into a really large company. Now, the media coverage for Steve Jobs' death over the past week has been huge. I mean, I remember seeing it. I saw it first on Twitter. It was trending on Twitter straight away, and people who had no interest in the world of IT were tweeting, "Rest in peace, Steve Jobs," and it caught the attention of a lot of people.
Well, his products were everywhere, weren't they? But he innovated the mobile market. I mean, I know there's other guys behind the scenes that you don't hear of, but really, Steve Jobs has created this whole, Steve Jobs and his team, I should say, have created this whole mobile revolution that we're seeing at the moment. And there's not a lot of people now that don't have these, you know, these mobile bits of hardware, you know, like iPads, iPhones. To a certain extent, he's created the tablet market. I mean, if it wasn't for the iPad, you probably wouldn't have. I know, was it Microsoft had a stab at the tablet market years back, but it didn't come to anything. I think that might have been early 2000s.
Well, he certainly had the vision to take computing to the mobile market, and that is the future, obviously, of computing: smartphones, mobile tablets, and just making computing much more accessible than it is today. I mean, you have laptops, which is a laptop is an accessible device, but I mean, looking at like the likes of iPhones and Android phones. I mean, the mobile market today is huge, absolutely huge. And if you look back 10 years, you look at the likes of, the remember the basic Nokia phones with Snake on them. And even before them, you had the brick phones. If anyone is a fan of Saved by the Bell, if they remember Zach Morris's big brick white cell phone that he had. It just shows how far we have come in terms of technology. It was a huge impact. I don't know if you were... I was looking at one... I mean, not everyone has been kind to Steve Jobs' death, but I was looking at one, I found it humorous. If anyone's familiar with the Westboro Baptist Church, it's a group of fundamentalist Christians over in the States, and they were tweeting about the death of Steve Jobs and how he's going to go to hell, etc., and they tweeted on an iPad, so there you go.
The Westboro Baptist Church, I've had hours and hours of amusement at the... They're just like religious trolls, aren't they? Everything they do, they're just trolls.
Yeah, well, I mean, the difference between them and a lot of people is that they take the Bible literally. I'm not a religious person. I'm unashamedly atheist. But if someone has their faith, that's fine. But what the Westboro Baptist Church do is they take it very literally. I mean, the Adam and Eve story, Noah's Ark, they take it all very literally, and they act upon it. I think the media does them a service by giving them publicity. If they didn't give them publicity, nobody'd really know about them. They'd just be some run-of-the-mill nobody religious fundamentalist group of about 50 people in some backwater town. But they've given them the media attention and they've given them more access than they would have. But I don't want to talk any more about the Westboro Baptist Church because it would be hypocritical to give them attention. They're just trolls. Moving along.
Well, if we go from trolls to hobbits...
Trolls to hobbits, yeah.
There was a quote by Richard Stallman. It's quite an interesting quote. Actually, I think he put it on his blog saying, Steve Jobs, the pioneer of the computer, is a jail made cool, designed to sever fools from their freedom, has died. I don't know what to make of that, really.
Well, not everyone was a fan of Steve Jobs. There's an article on Gawker.com, which it's titled, What Everyone is Too Polite to Say About Steve Jobs. And it goes on to criticize Steve Jobs, his record in terms of how he treated his employees. It discusses sweatshops, child labor, human rights, homophobia. There's a lot in there. I don't want to go in depth on it because it's not my view. In terms of Steve Jobs' personal life, I'm not too educated about it. But if someone wants to read the article, just Google it. It's on Gawker.com, and it's called "What Everyone Is Too Polite to Say About Steve Jobs." It's an interesting take on his life. Obviously, a lot of people who make it to the top of the corporate world do so on the backs of many others. I think that's something that we have to acknowledge. It's an article worth reading for sure.
I think you've got to put it in context as well. Regardless of what has happened in Steve Jobs' personal life, or regardless of what Steve Jobs' character is, or was, I should say, it doesn't detract from what he has accomplished professionally. And I think when someone who's famous dies, there's always a lot of muddle get thrown about people's personal lives, and there's always two sides of the fence. There's the people who want to who will say what a great person that this person was, or there's the other side who'll say what a horrible person they were. But I think if you just look at it subjectively and just think, well, at the end of the day, I mean, he's done some brilliant things in the corporate world.
Sure, absolutely. So I've been reading some books as of late. I ordered Kevin Mitnick's new book, Ghost in the Wires. And I found it to be interesting. Most people here who are listening to this podcast will be aware of Kevin Mitnick, probably the world's most famous hacker and the world's most famous social engineer. Now, a lot of people would have become familiar about Kevin through the 2600 movement, through the documentary Freedom Downtime, which is a great documentary. It's freely available on YouTube, it discusses and looks at the life of Kevin Mitnick, but also other hackers who serve time for their actions. Now, while Kevin was going through this process, there was a movie released called Takedown, based on the accounts of John Markoff and Sioma Shimomura. And it was felt by many in the community, especially by Kevin himself, that the movie was an unfair portrayal of Kevin's life. So this is Kevin's first opportunity to kind of discuss his life and to explain in detail how he came to be the hacker that he is today and the person that he is today. And I found I don't want to give too much away about the book, but I found the book to be a really great read, and you get to understand the brilliance of Kevin Mitnick. Prior to this, I wasn't too sure how good of a hacker was Kevin Mitnick, how good of a social engineer he was. But having read it, I now understand that Kevin Mitnick is a great hacker, he's a great social engineer, and the way in which he accomplished the attacks and his persistence was just outstanding. I was really impressed by it. His attacks, he never knew when to quit. Even when he was being chased by the FBI and he was creating a new identity for himself, he was still hacking away. He knew the dangers, he knew the implications, but he couldn't stay away from it. It was obviously a very strong addiction for him. And it started off back when he was younger. He was involved. Well, he had an interest in magic. Then he got interested in ham radio, and he went from there to learn about the phone system, became a phone freaker, learned the ins and outs of the phone system, and he became a social engineer, which meant that he knew how the human mind operated. He knew how to pose a question in a certain way that he'd receive a response. He knew how to masquerade as a certain person to claim a certain authority to access information. And it's just a really great book. Anyone who's interested in the life of Kevin Mitnick should buy it. It's available on Amazon and all good bookstores. And it's a really great read. Also, I've ordered recently, Dick, I'm not sure if you've read it before, the Web Application Hacker's Handbook.
I've read, it was 2007.
Yeah.
Edition. I haven't read the new one. I need to.
Yeah. Sure. Well, the second edition of it's just been released this week. I've just ordered on Amazon. It hasn't come yet, but I'm looking forward to reading it because web hacking is sort of, I wouldn't say it's my speciality. I'm there's a lot of web hackers out there that are a lot better and a lot more proficient than I. But it's the area in which I have my most interest in. But I'm looking forward to reading it because I didn't read the first one in great detail, but I did skim over it and I found it to be really interesting. But it was just a PDF, and I just find reading PDFs to be very difficult. So I've ordered the book itself. I'm not being a cheapskate, and I'm going to go through it. I've been toying a lot as well with the likes of WebGo and that, and I've been coding a lot as well. So it's really going to expand my knowledge on web application hacking, and I look forward to giving it a good review. So what about yourself, Dick? Have you read any books as of late?
I haven't bought any new books for a while because I'm back at university, so money's being a bit tight because I'm still waiting for the student finance to pay up, and the last two books I bought were just sort of software development textbooks, unified modeling language stuff, all the boring stuff.
Yeah.
But I think the last sort of hacker book that I read would have been Kingpin.
Okay,
which is the one by Kevin Paulson.
Yeah, sure.
Basically, it talks about the life of Max Butler, or Max Vision, who was also known. It was a security consultant, White Hat. He was really clever, but he got into the card sharking market.
Okay.
He was called the Iceman, and basically, he did some pretty epic stuff. Like, he wasn't a fool. I think he's in jail at the moment.
Mm.
I don't want to give too much away in case. But I recommend that for a good read. But I don't recommend buying it on a Kindle.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have a Kindle myself. I'm old fashioned in that sense. I do prefer to read a normal book. I just find it easier to read. If I'm reading off a screen or anything, just to be difficult. I understand that the Kindle itself doesn't have a backlight and it kind of mimics a book, but I just prefer the good old-fashioned book itself, and you can kind of take it anywhere you want. There's a lot of good books out there kind of document the lives of hacking. I think one of them was about fiber optic. I think it was called Masters of Deception. I can't remember. I read it a good few years back. It was really interesting to read about how you can kind of control the phone system in the same way Kevin Mitnick did, and he was a really good hacker, really good freaker. It's interesting reading kind of older accounts of hacking from the 80s, and that time period was a really interesting period in terms of hacking. I think kind of the hacking that's going on today is a lot more malicious. People have no morals. They have they do it for ego rather than out of curiosity. So that's why I prefer to kind of read the older accounts of the older hackers from the 80s and early 90s.
I think there's also there's business in hacking now. There's there's online cyber gangs. I hate using the word cyber, but they've basically create malware, and they've got a business model, haven't they? And they make money out of doing it, out of exploiting. But that's life, and everything goes like that in the end, I suppose, one way or another. But while you were talking about paper copies, I would just like to express my anger at Amazon.
Go on, let it out.
Hey, this is the third Kindle that I've had, and the screen has broken, and it's broken by sitting on the table doing nothing but gathering dust. So if anyone from Amazon's listening, I just want to say that Amazon Kindle is crap, and you need to sort the screen out, and you need to send me a new one. In fact, you need to send me two Amazon Kindles, so get in touch at inetizen podcast@inetizen.org and send me some Kindles.
No, Amazon, you've been told.
That's it, you've been told.
Good stuff. And while they're at it, they can send me one or two. I don't have one. I'm old-fashioned.
They are good. I mean, the screen and everything's canny. I'm lapsing into Geordie here. Sorry
for anyone
who might be an international listener. Canny means good in North East English speak.
Excellent. So, moving along, I was just having a quick browse over ExploitDB today, as I usually do. There's a local Linux exploit which attacks a race condition, the PK exec. So it's a local privilege escalation exploit. It's one of the top local exploits on ExploitDB. Also, there's a remote buffer overflow for script FTP 3.3 for Windows. Looking at some web apps exploits, we have a Joomla, a components time returns SQL injection attack, and also Nexus PHP 1.5 SQL injection attack. So these usually include some Google Docs, so they're very easy to locate. Anybody who's interested, I suppose, in Google Docing. And also, I was looking at a paper on there today. It's a really interesting paper. It's called Beyond SQL Injection, Obfuscate and Bypass. And what it looks at is, I suppose, bypassing web application firewalls, which is, it's an interest of mine and something that I'm always reading about and trying to educate myself a little bit further about. So it's definitely worth looking at. It's definitely worth checking out.
On the subject of web application firewalls, I just want to remind the listeners about Flawed.
Sure, yeah.
We've got it up on the website still, just in case anyone had. I'll let it's your baby.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not anything too major. There's not a lot of code in it. All it is it's a simple PHP script, and what it does is it attempts to mimic a web application firewall at various levels. So the first level, there's no filtering involved. It just to introduce some of the SQL injection. The second level mimics a very, very weak and basic web application firewall, which any basic filter bypassing technique should work. And the third and fourth levels kind of increment on that and they become more difficult and more difficult. And I'll try add more levels as I go along. I've just been kind of busy reading and kind of I'm coding a Twitter clone at the moment. Just for fun, I won't be releasing it. It's just because I want to work on reading a little bit more about jQuery. jQuery is it's the hot thing now in web development. So I want to understand some basic jQuery, but I want to kind of implement it a bit more in some web applications. So I'm doing a Twitter clone, and that's kind of keep me busy at the moment. So I probably won't be updating Flawed for a while. But anyone's who just wants to learn SQL injection, even if they don't want to learn about a WAF evasion just yet, and they feel it's a little bit too much for them, they can just download it and just practice level one. And the object of it, obviously, is just to get fake credit card details for Bill Gates and a few other guys. The installation instructions are in the README file. I haven't created an installation script, but I've included a SQL file. So all you do is just go into phpMyAdmin, go to the SQL code section, just paste the SQL code in and press go or run, whatever it says, and it'll actually create the tables, columns and all the data for them. So it's very relatively straightforward. That's Flawed, and it's available on inetizen.org in the code section.
I mean, I know we've covered it before, but I just thought we'd be in away for a couple of weeks. With me as well, remind anyone who might be new to the show or who's forgotten about us. So
yeah, that's fine. Also, we were meant to have Beav on last week on the show, but obviously, myself and Dick were sick, so we had to postpone it, and Beav wasn't available tonight, but he did get back to me, and he said he will be on the show with us next week, so we'll have Beav on. We're going to get him to talk about the DetRow OpenVMS cluster for anyone who's interested in the OpenVMS operating system. We'll also get him to talk about the Telefreak project, which is a public PBX for anyone who wants to learn about phones and the phone system and so forth. A very interesting project. There's also an old school BBS up there. Now, I've created a shell account on both the Telefreak BBS. I've also created a shell on the Vistek, the DetRow OpenVMS cluster. Now, I'm not overly knowledgeable about open VMS, but I have created a shell. I created a shell a few months back, and I've been learning bits and pieces as I go along. I create my own little website on there, and I've been just kind of learning how to navigate and some basic kind of commands and so forth. It's just one of those operating systems that a lot of people overlook, and it's not used as much as it obviously would have been back in the day when it was based on VAX systems. I think it was originally called VAX VMS. They would have been a lot more common back in the day. But it's just one of those operating systems that people should look at just to become familiar with, you know, alternatives to Windows and Linux and Unix. I also had a look at, there was an operating system I had installed about 10 years ago, or even a little bit more than that. It was called BEOS, and there's a new implementation of it now called Haiku. And you can download the virtual machine, the virtual image of it, and just check it out. It's an interesting operating system. You know, it's just, once again, expanding the horizons, becoming more familiar with the various operating systems out there.
I remember BEOS from a while back. I never actually downloaded it. It's not Linux, is it? It's something in its own right, isn't it?
Yeah, it's its own operating system. But it does have a bash shell, and the file system structure kind of resembles Linux, but it's not Linux. It's not a Unix operating system. It's its own operating system. I suppose you could compare it as a kind of a hybrid between Windows and Linux, but it's its own system. I actually had an IRC client installed on my version, so I popped onto the 2600 IRC server. Just give a shout out to 2600. Anybody who's looking for a decent IRC server, it's irc.2600.net, and make sure to pop into the 2600 channel, the Telefreak channel, the VMS channel, which is the Detro cluster, and also the Irish 2600 channel, which is 2600IE. They're all the good channels. The rest of the channels are shit. No, I'm just kidding. I don't go into any. I don't go into the other channels. I'm happy enough with those. But definitely check it out. It's a good community. A lot of knowledgeable guys on there.
I've been in some of the other channels, and you're right, they are shit.
we'll come back next week now, and the Iron Edison webpage will be defaced with, "Our channel is not shit. How dare you?" So. Yeah, but I'm looking forward to getting Beav on anyways next week. And he's given a lot of really good talks. He's given talks at DEF CON. There was a good discussion on the X25 networks that are still running today. And like the kind of Eastern and, you know, Eastern European nations like Russia and China that still use these networks. And he also discusses connecting... to analog networks using that voice over internet protocol, VoIP. And a lot of talks he's given are really interesting. You can go onto securitytube.com.net, securitytube, just Google it, and you'll find some of Beav's talks on there. Very, very interesting. He also usually talks alongside Jay Falcon. Well, I said that very weird. and they can both be filmed in the Telefreak channel.
Yeah, sorry, I've got the giggles now. I'm going to have to stop.
It's okay.
Whoa.
This is the podcast drugs. That's what's happening to us.
It's really late at night, I think. What time is it? It's 10 to 12 at night. And I get a bit silly at this time of night, don't I, Pion?
You're always silly, don't I?
Well, while we're talking about SecurityTube, I actually forgot to mention the SecurityTube. SecurityTube is actually doing certifications now.
Yeah, I saw that. They're doing a wireless security certification.
Yeah. I was just navigating to the page and Vivek started talking on a video.
Sure.
So I was just trying to click it off there. But yeah, they've got basically from what I gather, most of the materials already on the site. And it's free. But for an introductory price of $200, you get the certification exam.
Sure.
So, I think they're looking at creating a more affordable way of getting certified than
yeah.
other, I think than once, other companies out there.
Sure. The problem with certification is that it has to become an industry standard before it's kind of accepted as a kind of valid certification, and that's the real difficulty for a lot of them out there. But I like Vivek. I've watched a lot of his videos. He offers a there's two great video series if anybody's interested in programming. One is assembly language for hackers, and the other one is Buffer Overflow Primer. Now they run about 10 videos each, but they're very, very solid videos. And Vivek's a great teacher. So if anybody is interested in just kind of learn about assembly if they never had a chance to learn it, and also learn about how to write Buffer Overflow exploits, just pop on to SecurityTube. You'll see the primers on there. Really great videos, and Vivek is a really, really smart guy, and it's a really great website he's got going there.
No, I think they've got a good user base, SecurityTube. So I think the certifications might be one to watch as they develop over the next couple of years. I think I might find that there could be another force in town.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it'll take time before anything like that becomes industry standard. But if anything, people just check out Vivek's website, SecurityTube. Is it .com?
.net,
securitytube.net. Very good, very good website, and there's a lot of very good resources for anybody who's looking to learn via the medium of video. So, like I said, next week we'll be talking to Beav, and we'll be discussing the Telefreak and OpenVMS projects they've got running there. And anybody who's interested in OpenVMS or Telefreak, go to detrow.vistech.net. So that's detrow.vistech.net. So detrow.vistech.net, that's their OpenVMS cluster. And you can apply for a free OpenVMS shell there if you want to learn about OpenVMS. Or alternatively, if you're interested in Telefreak projects, just the telephone system, learn about PBXs, and just having a chat with like-minded people, pop onto telefreak.org, another very good project there by Beav. Also, I'd like to send a shout out to Warspeed, who's unfortunately not well at the moment. We wish you a speedy recovery, and we hope to have you on a show either next week or the week after that. Be good to see you on the show with us.
Yeah, get well soon, buddy, and it'll be brilliant to have you on the show, because we're looking at adding a third member to the show, aren't we, Pion?
Yeah, absolutely, and Warspeed is a very intelligent guy. He's got two CCIEs from Cisco, and anybody who's familiar with networking understands how difficult CCIE certification is to get. It's probably one of the hardest IT certifications in the world, if not the most difficult. So he's a very intelligent guy, and he'll bring a lot to the show.
He's got two of them.
Yeah, he's got two, so there you go. So a great guy, and we hope to have him on the show soon, and speedy recovery out there to our speed.
Yeah.
So until next week, this has been the fourth episode of the iNetizen Security Podcast. I'm Pion.
And I'm Dick Turnip, about to go and die in a corner because I'm still full of cold.
So until next week, that's all from now. Goodbye.
Night-night.
Psychosomatic. That boy needs therapy. Lie down on the couch. What does that mean? You're a nut.